back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Chad's back. We're up north and asking the question, where did things start to go wrong for Jon at the Wall? Then Steve and I cover the House of Black and White. And for my Bird's Eye View section, I will include an excerpt of my conversation with Dr. Ian McGuinness of the University of Highlands and Islands in Scotland. In that conversation, I will do my best to compare the Night's Watch to some of the medieval militaristic orders. And then Ian's going to set me straight on a few points. Without further ado, here is Dr. Chad Carmichael. Chad Carmichael.
That's me.
If you had to choose, would you want to be a ranger, a builder, or a steward?
Well, I want to say ranger, because then you're one of the cool guys, but rangers are putting their life at risk. And so, you know, there's another part of me that says maybe you should choose a less dangerous position, right? And so so I'm conflicted, in short. What about you?
I think that being a builder is best.
Uh-huh.
My feeling is that being a ranger is not just dangerous.
Yeah.
It's like going to seek out danger. It's like,
right,
here are these people who their only crime is that they were born on the wrong side of this wall. And you got to go like stir
up shit.
Well,
that's not their only crime. It's not their only crime. Let's be honest here.
I mean, what's their crime? Their crime is that they were born on the wrong side of this wall.
They live in a culture with institutionalized kidnapping of women.
Yeah.
There's a lot of murder and nonsense going on up in, among the wild.
Yeah, there is a lot of murder and nonsense, but it's not like there's not murder and nonsense south of the wall.
Yeah, sure.
And the Night's Watch job is to go and harass the people north of the wall. That's my point.
Right. Sure.
And they're good at murder, right? So let's say that there's a lot of murderous nonsense going on north of the wall. They're good at it. They're good at the right. murder. And you have to go harass the people who are good at murder.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's wrong-headed. And I think that it's on top of that, it's you're just asking to be killed.
Yeah. I mean, your job is to go range through a haunted forest filled with, like, murderers and monsters. I mean, it sounds like a terrible job.
It's not a good job. I think that being a steward is probably not the best idea.
Well, as we talk about this, I'm realizing how I'm not really cut out for any of the three positions. And that way I'm a little like Sam.
Well, stewards do a lot of stuff. Stewards do a lot of stuff. I mean, they do everything
from
cooking
really
to farming to, you know, chopping wood.
I mean, I'm sure I could, you know, sweep some floors or something, but I'm not very good at that sort of thing.
See, I think you're selling yourself short. I've seen you chop wood before, Chad. You're a pretty good wood chopper.
You have not seen me chop wood.
Sure I have.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
And I feel that I'm not good at chopping wood, so it's funny that you say that.
I feel I have a memory of you chopping wood.
I only recently got a really large axe last year because we got some extra firewood because of the pandemic, and we wanted to have some more fires. And I was out there thinking that I would chop wood, and it's a lot harder than you think. <It's>... It takes practice.
Okay. Maybe I just dreamt it.
Yeah.
I was dreaming of a shirtless Chad Carmichael out chopping wood and eating pancakes.
Sure.
No, I think
I'm
builder.
Not good at it.
Definitely
so.
You I think that you would want to be a builder because you would learn the craft. And
you're very handy. You're a handy guy. You're good at that sort of thing. And I could see you as a builder. I think you'd be really helpful.
Okay. Well, I would like to be a builder, and you're saying you're more like Samwell Tarly.
Yeah, I don't really fit into any of the three positions, and I think I'd be a lot happier as a maester.
So you would want someone to like go to Maester Aemon and say, look, this guy, he's not good at much, but he likes to read and he can write a little bit and he's good with numbers. Take Chad under your wing.
I mean, it makes me feel a little bit ashamed, and I don't think I'm as cowardly as Samuel, but but if I'm being honest, I don't think I'm really cut out to be a warrior. And I don't really think I'm cut out to be a steward or a builder. So I don't know where that leaves me. And, you know, I am a studious kind of person. So
you are. But I will say this. If you had been born in a previous time.
Yeah.
Your height alone would bring certain expectations.
Yeah.
Like people would expect you to go out and poke some wildlings in the guts with your
sure.
pointy objects and whatnot.
Right. No, I feel like this is an affliction of tall people. People expect us to be good athletes and good at basketball.
I don't like expect that. Much. I just expect you to get things off the top shelf for me when I ask.
All right. I can do that.
And visit my dreams from time to time, shirtless with an axe.
That I can't promise.
I'm going to read the synopsis of this chapter. This is John's fifth POV chapter. Alistair Thorne announces that 8 of the recruits have passed and will be allowed to take vows as men of the Night's Watch. The boys celebrate with wine, wrestling, and a snowball fight. That night, they are treated to a special feast and talk over the various callings within the Brotherhood. Halder hopes he will be a builder. Gren wants to be a ranger. Seemingly, no one wants to be a steward. But John is preoccupied with the plight of Samwell Tarly. He is convinced that Sam's life is in danger. Thorne, no doubt, will continue his attempt to beat the cowardice out of Sam. Worse still, Rast and Kudger might actually kill him. John rides out to let Ghost hunt and wonders if he should leave the wall behind before he takes his vows. But the notion is short-lived. Though after hours, he demands an audience with Maester Aemon. John tries to convince Aemon to take Sam under the Maester's wing and save him from the designs of Alistair Thorne. So, Chad, would you like to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
I think it's a theme I want today.
Ooh, good. I don't know if anyone's chosen a theme before.
Yeah, you can tell me if this is a theme.
Okay.
It's the institution of the Night's Watch, and specifically the process of becoming, the motivations in the process of becoming, of taking the black.
That's a motif.
A motif, not a theme. Right. I'm choosing a motif then.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine. All right, say it again, because I was winding up for my joke and I didn't quite hear what you were going to say.
You had already decided whatever I was going to say was a motif.
Yep.
So just the process of taking the black and then the, you know, some other institutional questions.
Yeah, fantastic.
So one thing that stood out to me was just, you know, you're sort of invited to think about John's decision to become a member of the Night's Watch in this chapter. And I mean, when he's thinking about running off and not doing it, I don't know about you, but I'm sitting there thinking, well, of course you should leave. I mean,
yeah, it's right. Just,
it's no kind of life for a promising young man. I mean, you have so much to offer and you're going to be up here in this group of, I think, a lot of criminals. And
well, and he's been able to see what the institution actually is now, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you're right. He should leave, crumbling. Right? He should leave.
Yeah. He's going to be this one little shiny brick in this sort of crumbling wall. Is kind of what it seems like, because it seems like he would make an excellent hedge knight if that were allowed.
I mean, you can rise really high as a bastard, for instance. Like yeah. You could be hand of the king. You could be normalized. You could be king
right,
one
sure.
day. You know,
sure.
There are sort of limits. But even so, with a little bit of Ned's help, yeah. He could have or Rob's help or whatever. He could have a pretty good life.
We have to remember, you know, he's a very young guy, and I think the motivations that he has are just. I don't know. They're the kind of motivations that you might expect for a young man. You know, I think his father admires someone who takes the black.
Yeah.
So that's important to him. And I think he looks up to his uncle. And so both of those things are playing, I think, a big role. Some of the reasoning, it just isn't very good. Like he doesn't really want to be at Winterfell anymore because he doesn't feel like he's part of the family and he doesn't feel welcome. And yet there are so many other places he could go than the wall. He seems to have kind of that as the only other option in his mind. But obviously, if he became a hedge knight, he wouldn't have to stay in Winterfell.
Here's what he's thinking. He's looking at the King's Road, and he's thinking about all the places he'll never visit. And then it says, once he swore his vow, the wall would be his home until he was old as Maester Aemon. I have not sworn yet, he muttered. He was no outlaw. Bound to take the black or pay a penalty for his crimes, he had come here freely, and he might leave freely. until he said the words. He need only ride on, and he could leave it all behind. By the time the moon was full again, he would be back in Winterfell with his brothers. Your half-brothers, a voice inside him said, and Lady Stark will not welcome you. So then he's having second and third thoughts, I suppose.
But listen to how, when he thinks about leaving, the only thing he thinks about is going back to Winterfell, where he's kind of unhappy.
Yeah, that's the only life he's ever known, right?
That's right. And I think this is true of young people. They're not always very good. I mean, maybe this is true of all of us. We're not very good at seeing all of our options.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We narrow it down for no good reason. And, you know, he should have been considering other options. And if I could talk to him, that's what I'd
do. What would you tell him his options were? Chad, I mean, well, you're a good person at giving this kind of life advice.
It seems like he's cut out to be a hedge knight. That's the thing that occurs to me. It also sounds like he wants to travel, and so it seems like he could try traveling for a while and see what opportunities emerge. He probably hasn't even considered the possibility that he might go overseas.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's a dangerous world, and I myself don't know how wise any of those options really are, because I don't know that much about what's involved in becoming a hedge knight mm-hmm. or traveling in this world. But these are the kinds of things I think he should be thinking about if his other option is taking the black.
I think he thinks that he wants to live a life of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he thinks if they let me just range beyond the wall and become my own person, then I will equip myself well. I'm the best rider of the bunch. I'm the best with the sword. I'm going to rise pretty fast here. And that will make me special in the way that Rob was special.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think he's thinking. So in other words, being a ranger, becoming a ranger is his way out of his kind of social predicament.
So I would say a few things to him. Number one, I would say, your perspective on Rob is going to be different in 10 years, no matter what you do. And so that, in my opinion, it probably shouldn't play a huge role. Mm. And number two, I would say you can take the black whenever you want. You can take it 5 years from now. And so there's no reason to rush into it.
Right.
Number three, I would wonder, and maybe you know the answer to this question, I would wonder what would happen if he sought adventure north of the wall but did not take the black. Is that not allowed? Would somebody stop him from doing that? What if he showed up north of the wall and he told the black brothers, I want to range with you, but I'm not taking the black. Would they say no to him?
Yeah, they'd kick him back.
You think so?
Go back to Ned Stark.
Yeah.
Pipsqueak. I mean, of course, he could absolutely sneak over the wall.
Right.
But that's like, it's like dying. It's like stepping off the edge of the world.
Just go with them. And the thing is about John is that he has the goods, so he would really make a contribution, even though.
So here's what he should do. There's no question in my mind what he should do.
Okay.
Should go back to Winterfell and learn everything there is to know about blacksmithing from, mm-hmm. you know, the armorer in Winterfell. Then he should take the knowledge that he has and a little bit of money, and he should go live in Dorne, be a blacksmith in Dorne. That's the best thing that you could do if you're Jon Snow.
He's not cut out for blacksmithing.
Sure he is.
He wants adventure. He wants to fight. He's a gifted swordsman. He wants to develop that part of his life. So
yeah, the climate probably wouldn't suit him.
And I think you're underestimating the misery that that Catelyn has inflicted on him at Winterfell.
Maybe so. It could be. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that he's come to love some of these brothers of the Night's Watch. Like, yeah. I think that he and Sam were as close as any of his other brothers were.
What do you think about his play with Sam and protecting him?
Yeah.
And threatening the other guys who are mean to him and then mm-hmm. trying to get him a special position?
Yeah. Well, one could argue, Chad, that this is the chapter that ultimately gets Jon Snow killed.
Yeah.
And it seems, you know, we're dealing with sort of Ned down south and Tyrion at the Eyrie, and the stakes all seem very high. The stakes seem very low at the wall right now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I do think that this chapter is exactly the kind of thing that Alistair Thorne will not forget. There was a chapter previous where he made a joke at Alistair Thorne's expense or something. Alistair Thorne is not going to kill you over that.
Yeah.
But what he does in this chapter, he goes to Maester Aemon. So he like sidesteps all of the ranks of the Night's Watch and tries to save Sam from the standard recruitment process.
Mm-hmm.
And really kind of cut Alistair Thorne off at the knees.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that Alistair Thorne is ever going to forgive John for this.
So you think it was politically unwise?
It was politically unwise, maybe so. Or, you know, it could be that, like, Alistair Thorne was going to be his enemy no matter what. But this is the kind of thing that's just going to emasculate a man like Alistair Thorne. He's not going to forget it.
And do you think it was a good idea to aggressively push Sam forward through the process?
I mean, it definitely helped Sam, right? It might have saved Sam's life.
Yeah, maybe. So this is what I was thinking about. In the U.S. military, a certain number of people don't make it through basic training. It's not a lot. I Googled it, I found a number of 15%.
Right.
I mean, whatever you think about the U.S. military, it's really good at training soldiers. So I suspect that a certain number of people should wash out.
Yeah, I think that we should be thinking about the Night's Watch more like a medieval monastic enclave or something. And they would, you know, there would be a process of being an acolyte for this very reason. You know, you come and live with us and you shovel our manure and you clean our dishes for 3 or 4 years. And if you think this is the work for you, then you can choose to stay. Or if we think that you're a good fit here, you can choose to stay. But there's that sort of period of being an acolyte. But what the Night's Watch is, the Night's Watch also believes that they are like holding back the darkness. And so they need as many men as they can get. So they're not going to wash Sam out. They're going to keep throwing men at him, keep throwing swords at him, trying to beat the cowardice out of him.
Yeah.
They're not going to wash him out. He's going to die.
You don't think that Sam Tarly ever could have come through that process?
Well, here's what John says. John says, look, if Sam's father couldn't make a man out of him, there's no way Alistair Thorne's going to make a man out of him.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense we're thinking like about manhood, right? Like, in other words, Alistair Thorne thinks that every man at the Night's Watch needs to be a warrior. It's not just the Rangers or whatever. That even if you're a cook, if it comes down to it, you better be able to pick up a sword. You know, I can understand the mentality that would think that. But the logic that John uses with Maester Aemon is like, look, this is a community. We need people that are talented in a number of ways. And someone who can read and write is really valuable. Why are we throwing his life away?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I do think that it certainly was a mercy to Sam to do this. It also could be the thing that gets John killed ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that struck me was how boyish all of these recruits are.
Yeah.
You know, you get the sense that every now and again they send up sort of this grizzled prisoner or whatever.
Right.
But it seems like this group of recruits, they're boys, you know, they're having snowball fights and they're squirting wine in each other's faces and boyish concerns. And, you know, they're talking like teenagers, you know, it feels a little bit like kids play, but at the same time, it's like, this is actually a major life decision that they're about to make.
I think that's part of the reason I thought about military training. You know, most guys that go into the military go pretty young.
Sure. Yeah, I guess you're right.
And there's something I think it reminded me of that. You know, it's a big decision.
I want to tell you a story about my son.
Yeah.
So yesterday he's kind of complaining about these people in his classroom.
Yeah.
He's like really annoyed. It's like he's aged out of this classroom. And I keep in mind this classroom includes 7th and 8th graders, and he's an 8th grader. So he calls a meeting with like all the students in the classroom and he proposes that they should ban 3 phrases from the classroom. That's what she said. Your mom and my nuts.
Good luck.
And I don't get the sense that like he's not the kind of kid who's like gonna be offended by this kind of stuff. But he, I think it's just like you those three phrases are used so often it's become
Sure.
annoying.
Right.
And that's a little bit like Jon Snow's leadership, I suppose. It's sort of like
It's just
informal peer leadership.
yeah, it's so funny that so every once in a while a boy gets it in his mind that it's even conceivable that a group of boys of that age group would be possible to lead in that way, you
I know.
know? It's like you what you have done now is you have increased the amount that those words will be used,
Absolutely. And now they're
especially
going
in
to
your
say it just to
direction.
annoy him.
Yeah, especially toward you, right? So that was a big mistake.
Yeah, so it was a very Jon Snow kind of move. All right, here's a question for you. Why do the elites of the Night's Watch get to keep their family name? Like, why does Benjen get to keep being called a Stark? I thought that you left that kind of stuff behind when you became a brother of the Night's Watch.
Is he called Benjen Stark in this?
Yes, they keep calling him Benjen Stark.
That's interesting.
And they call him Lord Mormont. They call him the Old Bear a lot. But
Right.
he's Lord Mormont.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it's like even it's just one more sort of subtle clue that embedded class distinction is, finds its way into the Night's Watch as much as anywhere else, I suppose.
Yeah, but not Aemon though, right? He doesn't have his.
He doesn't, and I was wondering about that. That's probably because specifically the Maesters do not reveal their family names.
That's right. That's right. Interesting.
So
But of course, that's supposed to generally be true for the Night's Watch as well, right?
I thought so too. And then I was reading this chapter and I was thinking, why is Benjen always referred to as Benjen Stark? All right, notable introductions, Chad. We hear of Guirin. We are introduced to Mathar and Cletus and Chet and their notably ugly faces. And interesting to me is that this, I think this is the first time that giants are mentioned in a way that makes you think, do they really believe in giants? Like, we've had references before to like Hodor looks like a giant,
Yeah.
or Maester Aemon calling Tyrion a giant, or something like that.
Right.
But in this chapter, John says, hey, rangers, or at least the narrator tells us that rangers are the kinds of people that go up north and fight giants and monstrous snow bears. In a way that makes you think, like, I mean, certainly there are going to be legends about giants and whatnot, but then the question is, these men of the Night's Watch, they're supposed to be serious men
Right.
who do serious things. And so the question is, do they believe in giants? And of
Right.
course, we know that eventually John will meet a giant, but I think this is the first time that concept is introduced.
Right. Yeah, a little clearly there's Grumpkins and Snarks are like always mentioned in a kind of dismissive way, right?
Sure, right.
But giants maybe are a little less clear.
A notable difference with the show, this particular chapter is very different than the show. And John writing off and thinking, maybe I should just go south. All that sort of interior world of John's mind, that's not
Right.
represented. John doesn't really write out in the show until he thinks that I need to go help my brother.
Yeah.
And then he has that conversation with Maester Aemon. So a lot of what happens in this chapter is not represented in the show.
Right.
Okay, so this chapter again, as all the John chapters do in this book so far, keep hitting me over the head with this reminder that Benjen Stark is missing. It's like over and over and over. You can't escape it. It's like constantly reminding the reader that Benjen Stark is missing. And to my mind, that means that eventually Martin has to pay this off, right?
Yeah.
So, Chad, what do you think happened to Ben? What's gonna what how are we going to pay off this theme?
I don't really know. I don't really have a view.
This is one of those times where you're just like, in all of John's chapters, he's talking about Uncle Benjen. And we never find out what happens. Like, one of the things that I think, well, I got to find out. I have to find out what happens to Benjen at some point.
I mean, you must have a theory, right?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Does the internet have a theory? Surely the internet has a theory. I'm not up on all these things.
The internet doesn't know either, Chad. That'd be great. That'd be great to go on like a Reddit forum and just have like 14 posts that just all say, yeah, we don't know. You're right. We don't know. Not enough information. You're right. We don't know.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I cover episode 2 of season 5. Arya's in Braavos, Jaime and Bronn are heading to Dorne, and Jon becomes Lord Commander because Maester Aemon breaks the tie with his vote. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, I'm going to give you 5 different religions, and you're going to choose which one you would convert to if you had to convert.
Okay.
All right. So, faceless men. Pros of the faceless men, you might get to assassinate a few people and you can shapeshift.
Okay. No.
All right. They're kind of, I guess the con would be they're a little cultish and they're sort of a death cult. You know, you may have to die. So that's a con in it.
Seems problematic.
All right, so that's Faceless Men. Arya's gonna find herself in their temple, which is the House of Black and White. So they got a great temple. I mean, that's the other thing. Architecture and location is everything, right? You've got the old gods. So you know about these gods. They, you know, you might be able to...
Them, right?
No, these are the old gods.
Oh, the
these
old.
Like the tree worshiping. Like you're going to worship nature, you know, worship a tree spirit, and you may get to, if you're lucky, you may get to warg into a wolf.
Okay, so like Northern Oregon type.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's right. So the pros of this religion are, you know, if you like nature, you get a lot of nature. The cons of this religion is you might end up like fused into like the root system of a tree for the next 300 years.
Gotcha.
All right. So we got the Faceless Men, the old gods. We got the red god, which is, his name is R'hllor. This is the fire god. Mm. The fire god, pros of the fire god is... You can see visions in the fire.
Right.
And you can sometimes utilize a smoke baby to your own political ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cons are you might get burned at the stake.
Right. This all came up during the RNC, I believe.
Right. Exactly. All right. The drowned god. The drowned god is the Iron Islander god. Mm-hmm. And the pros of this god are when you die, you get to go live under the sea with the drowned god. So like a Little Mermaid situation.
Okay.
The cons of this religion are they're never going to teach you to swim. Because even though you're on the sea a lot, dying by drowning is actually a good thing. So you never learn to swim.
Oh. Oh, yeah. You know, as we talked about in previous episodes, this might be right in my wheelhouse because I'm not that strong a swimmer.
That's right. Right. Finally, Faith of the Seven. So this is, this is the religion of King's Landing. You got seven different faces of God. It's kind of a little bit Trinitarian, but instead of three, you got seven. And the pros of this religion are, hey, nice, steady. If you need a kid blessed at birth or a wedding or a funeral, these septons and septas, they're gonna be there nice and steady. The cons of this religion is it's all there's like they're married to politics. Everyone's got a political motive. So it's sort of like this religio-political system. So rundown, Faceless Men, Old Gods, R'hllor, which is the fire god, drowned god, or the Faith of the Seven.
It's kind of hard to not judge the religion by the followers, right?
Kind of hard, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Greyjoy situation doesn't seem great. They seem like a surly lot.
They are, but man, if you want to party, I bet you those guys can party.
I bet, but I bet there's a certain amount of mildew that you have to tolerate.
That's fair enough. Fair enough.
Fire gods, been on fire before. So like, here's the thing. Like, so, I mean, I've got some interesting relationships with a lot of this, right? I mean, I've been on fire before, so I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of burning. So I might not want to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
That could be a problem.
But you're a fan of barbecue, right?
I am a fan of barbecue, but I think I might be on the preferring the smoked side as opposed to, you know, the seared.
But
it's, you know, it's I'm open. I can get on board with the old gods.
Yeah, a little nature worship for you.
Yeah, I could be part of the root system. There's worse things.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. It's good to know. You know me. You didn't ask, but I'll volunteer.
Thank you.
I'm all about Faith of the Seven, man.
Oh, okay.
And I'll tell you why. A lot of fans don't think Faith of the Seven would be a good choice because really what can they do? There's no magic behind it. It's all made up. It's all politics behind it. The power behind Faith of the Seven is the politics, right? But man, just give me a good, you know, good officiate at my wedding. Give me someone to do my funeral. I know what to expect. If you give me religious magic, I will freak out.
Okay.
For me, it's a bonus that there's not going to be any smoke babies or faceless men hanging around the religion. Okay. So that's me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it makes sense to when you put it in that way, but
I think I'm probably the voice in the wilderness on this topic. Yeah. Most fans would like some sort of supernatural power behind their religion. Not into it. Overrated.
Well, then it becomes, well, why have a religion, right?
It's comforting, man.
Comforting.
It's comforting.
I like that you...
I like social structure.
I like that you're Linus, who's in full... who's fully aware that his blanket does nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm Dumbo with the magic feather, and I kind of know that the feather is kind of bogus.
Yeah, like people think like, oh no, we lost the feather. We'll see if we can at least convince him that this new feather is the feather. And everybody's worried about it. You don't care. It's like, it's fine. These feathers are interchangeable.
Yeah, no, I like Faith of the Seven for the same reason I like baseball, you know? It's all contrived.
Right. It has the illusion of this romantic connection to history.
Sure, yeah. And I don't have to deal with people like Melisandre. I just don't want to deal with those people.
Right.
They can go do their thing. I don't need it in my life.
Interesting.
All right, so something that titillated you about this episode.
Titillation. I'm still into the wall.
Well, John gets kind of an offer, right?
Yeah, he gets an offer, and he gains Lord Commandership.
Well, yeah, he gets offered the thing that he's wanted his entire life, right?
Right.
Which is to be a Stark, and not just a Stark, but be like the Stark, right?
And then now he has to battle between the Oath, because again, he's a Stark. See, this is the beauty of it, right? He can be a Stark by name, or he can be a Stark by honor.
Yeah, right.
And so that's
he's all about honor, right?
Well, he's a Stark, man. Deep down. Right. And so in order to be a Stark by name, he has to, in his mind, kind of turn his back on what he would consider the oath keeping that would be true to his Stark name.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that. I like that tension.
And if he had taken the offer from Stannis, which you could have, no one would have faulted him for doing that.
No.
He said, finally, John's
and it works out for more
smart.
People, right? I mean, it works out. There's less divisiveness within the wall.
Right, right, right. That's right. I mean, from a very sort of, like, the consequences of doing that may be better for the most people.
Right.
Right. But because he doesn't take that, now he finds himself as the Lord Commander. So, yeah, his character is getting interesting, for sure. I like the scene also at the wall. I like the scene between Sam, Gilly, and Shireen.
Mm.
So Shireen is Stannis' daughter.
Right, right.
And she's teaching Gilly to read, and then Sam's kind of, you know, he's reading in the same room. And I kind of think that combination of characters works for some reason. Like, I feel like we have a little island of misfit toys thing happening. Sure. I think all these characters are, I mean, they've all known pain and they're all curious. And I like that Gilly has someone else besides Sam to interact with.
Yeah,
because I think that the Sam Gilly thing was kind of getting a little bit stale for me.
Right. Yeah, I wasn't, because it wasn't enough to keep me like, really. I'm like, okay. I mean, I like Sam and Gilly's relationship enough on the side, but if you're gonna keep giving it to me the way it was, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not working.
Yeah, I think that Gilly and Shireen are both characters that really need someone. They're coming from much different places, but they kind of need each other in this particular time and place. So I kind of like that.
Yeah, I agree.
Something that didn't work for you.
I don't know if I'm gonna love Dorne.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you and a lot of people.
Oh really?
Yeah, and you know what? This is not just a TV thing, because there's a lot of book readers that are just exhausted by the Dornish plot.
Really?
And it's sort of like, oh, come on, George. Just wrap it up. No one cares about Dorne.
Okay.
Nobody cares about Dorne. And he just spends like hundreds and hundreds of pages on Dorne.
That's kind of, I feel a little validated for somebody who's just going through this thing, you know, obviously for the first time. And I was kind of into Oberyn, and then I feel like he served his purpose, so I don't need any more of that.
Boy, Dorne would be a lot more interesting if Oberyn was still around.
I think that's my point. Like, you took the thing about this place that at least I was any bit invested in, and you popped it like a blackhead, and now what do I do?
Right. Now, I will say this. So, Prince of Dorne, mm-hmm. the guy who's just kind of sitting there the whole episode.
Yeah.
I am a little bit interested in what happens with this guy, because I feel like this is the first guy that we've met who is a little bit like, you know what? I don't want to go to war. I'm not into it.
Yeah.
I think peace is better for our people. These people that want to go to war, they just want blood and guts everywhere. And I would rather simply be isolationist and defend our borders. I don't think that we've seen that character yet in this show.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think that it brings with it a different set of consequences. You know, someone with wealth and power who just decides, nope, not getting into the war game.
This is all part of my 5-year plan. Everything's going according to what I wanted. I'm good.
Yeah, that's right. So I find that guy somewhat interesting. So I don't know. I'm a little bit jaded because of the general consensus of the fandom about the Dornish plot.
You want to be the sort of the counter point. Like, hey, let's give Dorne a chance.
I think I'd like to give Dorne a chance, but I will say this, just based on this episode, I liked that guy. I thought that guy's like, ooh, this is interesting. We haven't seen this type before. And I also like this whole Bronn Jaime exchange.
Yeah, that's got legs.
And that's part of the Dornish plot too. Okay. And I kind of like the idea that Bronn has finally got, you know, what he's been promised by these Lannisters. All of these, you know, they finally paid their debts.
Right.
And he's like jumped up from, you know, sellsword or cutthroat to knight, and now he's got a, you know, highborn wife, and he's gonna get a, you know, by hook or crook, he's gonna get a castle, and so he's finally, you know, cashing out. And then Jamie's like, hey, one last heist, man.
Right, exactly.
One last heist. I give you a better girl and a bigger castle.
Yeah.
So far, I know that the Dorne plot doesn't do it for a lot of people, but so far, I'm liking it. I'm liking the Bronn and Jaime together. I'd like to see them get into some hijinks.
All right. Hijinks go a long way.
Yeah. I tell you something I really like, Steve. I like Jaime's leather jacket.
Yeah, that's a nice touch, huh? It ticks you out of it for a second, but then it does feel like it's Han Solo.
It was a little bit jarring. It was like, wait, what?
Yeah, this was an option.
He's got the Fonz jacket on.
I know.
Did you ever have a leather jacket?
I did have a leather jacket once. It was Heather's leather jacket, and that she didn't want to wear it anymore, I think, or she liked the way it looked on me.
Zippers. All right.
And
she didn't like the way it looked on you, but you liked the way it looked.
No, she liked the way it looked on me, so that's why she gave it up.
But, like, deep down in your soul, you knew you weren't a leather jacket kind
of guy? I think so. I think that's accurate. Give me a corduroy blazer.
Sure. No, I get it. Yeah, it's like you've got to decide one of these days whether or not you're a house coat kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you decide you're not, then there's no reason to keep the house coat around.
You're right. Yeah.
Same thing with the leather jacket.
Yeah, you got to be that guy.
I don't think either one of us are that guy, Steve.
I don't think so. I don't think we are.
Yeah. That's okay. I mean, earlier in my life, that would have been a little depressing to me to know that I don't have the option.
Right. Now I find it liberating.
I once had a leather jacket. It was like suede.
Uh-huh.
And this was like back in the day where you had to buy like a ticket at the airport. And because I had some kind of voucher, and I went to the airport, and I didn't have enough money in my bank account to like buy the airplane ticket. I was like 20 years old, and so like I walked around the airport and I tried to sell my leather jacket.
Wow,
I needed $30 to get on the
airplane. Selling your leather jacket for a plane ticket?
I had like a voucher for like $70, and the airplane ticket was $100, so I just needed to sell the thing for $30.
Wow.
And I think I sold it for $35.
Wow, that seems weird.
Yeah. It was weird. I sold it to a guy who was like, you know, 6 inches taller than me, and the leather jacket definitely didn't fit him, but I told him he looked great.
Wow, it's weird. It's like it's the most non-scam scam.
I mean, he knew it was too short for him. He just needed someone to sort of help him live his dream of becoming the leather jacket.
He's like, look, if I can even just turn this into $40. Wow.
So I got the I was able to, you know, get the money, get on the airplane, and
that man's name was Jamie Lannister.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I will include an excerpt of my conversation with Ian McGuinness. Here we talk a little bit about the parallels between the Night's Watch and a few medieval militaristic orders. I've had a pet theory for a long time that the Night's Watch is really a monastic community, but this is the first time I've been able to talk over this theory with someone who's an expert on the topic. Here is Dr. Ian McGinnis. So you mentioned the Teutonic Knights and the Knights Templar, and you can definitely correct me here, but those orders, they viewed themselves as an arm of the church. Am I right in that, thinking that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they see themselves as being like a monastic order.
Yes,
right. But just for fighting men.
That's right. And if I remember my history correctly, these militaristic orders really did pattern themselves after a monastic brotherhood in many ways.
Yeah, they're set up in a similar way that the order by which they live by is based on monastic predecessors. And yes, there is the religious side of things is the kind of underpinning, although in part that's because the church chooses to support them. But in terms of what they do in the field, it is, you know, intensely militaristic, and when they're actually in combat, I think there's very little to distinguish them between between them and the rest of the knights round about them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I always considered the Night's Watch to be something of a hybrid between the monastic orders and these militaristic orders. But if you think about it, these militaristic orders initially were a branch off of a religious ideology in the first place. In other words, there are ways to serve God in the world from this perspective, and sometimes it's just to, you know, father children and raise crops, you know, so, and sometimes it's to give up everything and go live in a monastery. But of course, if you gave up everything and lived in a monastery, that was almost like a higher calling. And of course, correct me again, but some of these first crusades were propagandized as this is a way to be almost a monk with a sword. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think to an extent, but I don't know. I think the way that the orders kind of develop, that they grow somewhat organically. There is, you know, like the Hospitallers, for example, grow up on the back of the hospitals set up to tend for pilgrims, and even the Templars grow out of a need to defend and protect pilgrims as they travel to the Holy Land. I mean, they grow into very different things, the Templars in particular, and grow into this massive, financially lucrative group. But at their source, I think they are something a bit different. And yes, it's intrinsically tied into the crusade and to pilgrimage. The orders are adopted by the church, and that's where the rule comes from and things. But I think actually they do grow up organically. They're not created by the church. It's one of those cases where the church signs off on it after the fact, because it thinks this is a useful arm. But like all new developments, vaguely religiously affiliated, you know, they could potentially be problematic at the start.
Yeah.
Like the Franciscans.
I would say so. So I also want to hear you talk a little bit about the, you said that George goes out on a limb. tell me more about that.
Well, I don't know. I think he's kind of crafting something that is his own. You know, that because I was looking into some of this before, and the suggestion was that the Night's Watch are the kind of the dark side to the King's Guard, who are like the light, but both perform a similar function in as much as they're there to protect. They're there as a group of selfless, perhaps quasi monastic type, but military figures. I just wonder with the Night's Watch, perhaps the original idea of it is idealistic, but obviously where we are when we come to it now, it has sunk pretty low. It has to take in the waifs and the strays, the criminals, the treasonous, because nobody else will join it, and yet obviously as we go on to discover, performing an incredibly important duty is just that the importance of it has been forgotten over the years.
Well, yeah, the impetus for it has been forgotten over the years. They think that they're battling wildlings. You know, they're holding back the darkness in the form of wildlings. Clearly, the wall is for a different purpose. I did want to talk a little bit about whether or not we should think of the Night's Watch as a secular institution. So let me ask you this in a different way. Were any of these militaristic orders, let's say in the, I don't know, the 1200s, would they have considered themselves secular?
Good question. I think they would have to a decent degree. And I say that because while it is still a religious order and one absolutely, as I said, supported by the church, and one in which, you know, that rule of life, which is based on the monastic life, is key to how the organization functions, you know, how your day-to-day life is. At the same time, you are doing very non-monastic things, you know. Yes, you may well be looking after the sick, you may well be helping the poor, guarding pilgrims, but you're also involved in negotiations, you're involved in military action, whether offensive or defensive. You know, they are a lot more worldly than monastic communities. I don't know, not all monastic communities are insular. You know, you have ones who go out into the world as well. Right. But I think the military orders are something else again, just in large part because of that military function. I don't think, you know, the knighthood and medieval warfare is intrinsically tied up with religious ideas. You can't separate the two. But I still think that those...
Yeah, I think that the last point that you're making, that there's, it's hard to separate these things, is what has always kind of struck me as most compelling. But I think that, I also want to accept that, of course, things that have religious beginnings do not necessarily evolve in that way, I suppose.
No, and just because, you know, taking it back to Martin, but just because John and Sam take their vows, and indeed everyone else does as well, doesn't mean they stick to them.
Oh, yeah.
In any way.
My thanks again to Dr. McGinnis. Ian will be back with me to talk about the next Tyrion chapter. Finally, I'll mention again that Season 5 has a couple running themes. One is knights and chivalry. The other is trial by combat. If you have questions or comments about either of these themes, you can email me at book@baldmove.com. And of course, if I don't feel like I can address your comment or question, maybe, just maybe, I'll be able to find an expert on the topic and bring you back my research. So that's book@baldmove.com. And that's all for this week.